Dan, we're recording?
Yes.
Okay, I guess we'll get started. A few minutes after 10 o'clock. Folks on the phone, can you hear us reasonably well?
Yes.
Yes, we can hear you.
Fantastic. A note for the folks on the phone, if you have pulled music or pulled advertising or anything like that, please avoid sharing with us. We appreciate it. So good morning. I'm Alex Baker, Lighting Program Manager with the Energy Star Program. Steve Lumbo wants to chat. I think we're going to close that. So let's get started. Thanks to everyone for coming in today. Thanks to the folks on the phone for joining us. We're going to be running through the whole spec today. Let's get started. This is the agenda. First 15 minutes, we're just going to go around the room, introduce everyone, and talk through what it is that we're doing today. From 10:15 to 12:30, Dave Ryan from DNR International, he and I are going to switch off going through the specification, presenting you what's in the spec, presenting you analyses that went into the proposals that are in this draft one. From 12:30 to 1:30, we're going to have a lunch break. I think we're going to try to stick to that schedule, so if the morning session goes long, I think we're going to try to maintain 12:30 or 12:35, say, just for the benefit of the folks on the phone who are trying to keep to a schedule with us. So from 1:30 to 1:45, Eileen Eaton from the Consortium for Energy Efficiency will give a few comments about the draft one and about Energy Star's approach to lamp labeling generally. From 1:45 to 2 o'clock, we'll have NEMA do the same thing. And then from 2 o'clock to 2:15, Natural Resources Defense Council. Noah Horowitz is with us to help us with that. I should mention who from NEMA is presenting?
Alex.
Alex, great. Okay. Alex Rosenberg from NEMA from 1:45 to 2. We'll take a quick break just to grab coffee from 2:15 to 2:30. From 2:30 to 4:30, we have that time carved out for general discussion. So during the morning session, when we go through the specification, we're going to try to keep the Q&A really to just clarifying questions. So if something is not clear in the presentation, just put your hand up or call it out, and we'll try to address the quick questions then. For those items that are worthy of broader discussion later, we'll maintain a parking lot or a bike rack, as us EPAers call it, on this board over here. And so those items are what we will revisit from 2:30 to 4:30. Of course, you know, I recognize we have a lot of ground to cover in one day. To the extent that we don't get to that, please know you can always call us. You know, we can orchestrate conference calls. Of course, we're always listening on email as well. So we'll try to make this as open a discussion as possible today. And for the items we don't get to today, there will be time otherwise. And again, we're only on draft one, so we're just getting started. Some logistics for the folks in the room. Please wear your visitor badges at all times. So the security folks know who you are. There is no Wi-Fi available. I'm sorry about that. I think it's a security thing. We don't offer up Wi-Fi. The plugs in the wall for Ethernet, please don't plug anything into those. The IT folks tell me that if you do connect something, you have the potential to shut down that port, which could then potentially shut down the whole webinar, and that would be bad. For those who smoke, please don't smoke in the building. Restrooms. If you follow the path you came in, ladies' room, follow the path that you came in right before the double doors. The ladies' room is there. Men's room is straight down this hall on the left-hand side. Coffee is nearby. Down that same hall, there's a lunch room that has a snack and soda machine. Feel free to avail yourself of that. Lunch from 12:30 to 1:30. I'll put this slide up again later just to show you what your options are in the neighborhood. I had to beg and plead with our staff nurse to let go of this room so that we could have this meeting. So she kindly moved her blood drive out to a blood mobile on the street. So for those who want to donate some blood during lunch, please, you know, grab a quick snack and then go donate some blood. We'll all cheer you for that. just do a quick roll call. Again, I'm Alex Baker. Consultant today is Peter Banwell and Taylor Jamstell. We're happy to have Brian Berger from the Department of Energy joining us as well. Thank you for being here. From ICF International, providing support, we have Brian Carroll, Dan Cronin, Austin Gelder, Tammy Hernandez, Meredith Ledbetter. DNR International, Emily Penn Gruber and Dave Ryan, and from Lewis Spec Consulting, Howard Bullman. Now I think it's probably worthwhile to spend a few minutes go around the room, identify who you are and what company you're from.
Chad Stalker, Phillips Lumilus.
Pekka Hakkarainen with Lou Fraud and current chair of the NEMA Lighting Systems Division.
Joe Millett with Sylvania.
Jennifer Dolan with Sylvania.
Aaron Feit with GE, Feit Electric.
Alex Bosberg, NEMA, Manager of Regulatory Affairs.
Jane Giambauser, also Semiconductors.
Yeah, current LED Transformation.
Rich Passport, Power Integrations.
Ken Charton, MaxSight.
Tom Capone, also.
Noah Harp at NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Tim Henning, Cree LED Lighting.
Randy Abernathy from ACS.
Merlin Jack, from Six Flags Laboratory, Montreal.
Six Flags Laboratory, Five Flags Laboratory, Canada.
Yvart Lausums, Lighting Science Group.
Gary Harvey, Lighting Science Group.
James.
Jennifer
Barr,
Phillips.
Tim
Rosinski, NABLAT.
Austin Gelder, ICF International.
Sean Kander with Neutron.
Dave Geraci, ECP.
Dave Horowitz, McPhee Strategic Switch Lighting.
Phil Permisler, Mass Path Optics. Maurice Bosch, CRS Electronics.
Michael Houck, Save Watt USA.
Kevin Carpenter, Nexus Lighting.
Jeffrey Gibb, Nexus Lighting.
Brian Berger, Department of Energy. I'm
James Ryan, I'm with DNR International.
I'm Dan Cronin, ICF International.
I'm with
DNR
International.
Brian Carroll down the hallway. And I think we've got, probably have a few stragglers join us as well. Can somebody just hop on the phone and make sure they can hear us, because I'm concerned there's two types of mute on this panel over here.
Sure.
And I just want to make sure the folks on the phone can still hear us. So we have 140 people on the phone, and for the sake of time, we're not going to do a roll call of the folks on the phone, but I do want to point out Eileen Eaton from the Consortium for Energy Efficiency will be joining us remotely. Isabel Guimont from National Resources Canada, she is Minister of the Energy Star Program north of the border, so we're happy to have those folks joining us today. The focus of today's meeting is really to focus on the specification. What do we call an Energy Star lamp, qualified lamp? Questions and concerns, I just want to make sure that we maximize our use of the time. Questions and concerns regarding third-party certification as a whole, as a premise. It would be good to bring those up in another forum. Same for verification testing. We are open, and we'd like to have those conversations with you, but we need to remain focused on the specification itself today. Of course, to the extent that third-party certification and testing pertains to the spec, we should talk about that stuff, but any broader discussions about that, let's have that in another forum. EnergyStar.gov/third-party-cert is our clearinghouse of information for that. Switch over to another slide deck. Bear with me a second.
Oh, I don't know if I have that.
This is what they're talking about.
I know.
Great. Okay. So again, this has been the bulk of the morning going through the spec. Dave and I will bounce back and forth on this. Dave, chime in if I miss anything. I'll chime in if you miss anything. And here we go. So conceptually, big picture, here's what we're doing. Historically, the Energy Star program has maintained two two specifications for lamps or general service lamps. One, the compact fluorescent lamp spec, and the second being the integral LED lamp spec. So the intent here is to merge these two into one technology-neutral specification, taking this opportunity to increase the quality and reliability. We're trying to remain focused on consumer detractors or dissatisfiers, the things that keep consumers from engaging with efficient lamps, or the things that keep them from going back for more. We've only proposed minor efficacy increases, and we recognize that the efficacy levels that were proposed in draft one would need to be revisited. We'll finalize on whatever that's going to be, but we would need to revisit those after the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007, after that phase-in has been completed by 2014. So this outline of what we're going to talk about today is really just an outline of what the spec consists of. So we'll talk about the scope and lamp classification, photometric performance, lumen maintenance and reliability, intensity distribution, electrical, lamp toxics, dimensional requirements, and then lamp labeling and packaging requirements. So first we will talk about the scope and lamp classification. So what's proposed in draft one is that for ANSI standard omnidirectional shapes, including those listed on the screen, T/C, you learn something new every day. I learned that designated circle line. So self-balanced circle line, and 2D, I think that's self-explanatory, it's 2D-shaped lamps in one. Non-standard shape omnidirectional, we're recognizing that bare spirals of various sizes and configurations don't have ANSI standards associated with them. ANSI standard shape directional, your reflector, your RBRERPAR, non-standard shape directional, self-balanced compact fluorescent type decorative shapes, those shapes listed on the screen, and all of these combined with E26, the standard medium screw base, E12, the candelabra base, and we've got a lot of feedback during the specification framework. The partners would like us to add the intermediate base, so E17 has been proposed as well. Bayonet bases, we do have some play in other markets outside the United States, so just for the sake of thoroughness, that's in there. Multiple pin bases, I'm just using the terms that are in the ANSI specs, so GU24, GU5.3, GU10, etc. These are the lamps that are not included. We don't propose to cover linear fluorescent lamps that are not self-ballasted, so linear fluorescent lamps generally. Discrete pin-based compact fluorescent lamps, your four-pin type of lamps. LED replacement lamps for linear fluorescents. The DOE has done some analyses on those and continues to do so through the Caliper program and continues to find deficiencies with that approach. Also, generally speaking, the specification is focused on primarily consumer goods. To the extent that it's also useful for the commercial market, that's great, but we're really mostly focused on the general service lamps that go into consumer spaces. Low voltage lamps, we'll get into that in more detail. Other lamps that aren't included in this are solar-powered lamps. We're looking to label things that reduce load on the electric grid, so that's not part of our scope. This next item about power-consuming features that don't provide illumination, we've already fielded some feedback that could be restrictive for things that have lamps that have connectivity in it, so that's already on our radar. Lamp technologies that don't have industry-standardized methods of measurement, those present a real challenge for us to test them, so to the extent that we don't have test methods to point to, those are not included. Lamps that have bases that are not detailed in ANSI standards, as well as AUGA standardized LED light engines, those are not ANSI standard lamps, so those are not within the scope that has been proposed in draft one.
You mentioned GU10, but the spec says just GU24 is GU10.
I think there may be an error in the slide deck.
So is GU10 included?
GU10, I don't believe was in draft one.
But it was on your slides.
Yeah,
right.
I recognize that, yeah.
Just a quick point of clarification. This meeting is being recorded, and there's a bunch of people on the phone. So just as a general point of order, when you ask a question, just please identify yourself first. So that was Aaron Fite from Fite.
Yeah, that's an error in the slide deck. We can talk more. Actually, we'll talk about that more right here. The lampshade system, the majority of lamps included under the current program, are incorporated into the spec. So the lampshades that are within the CFL and individual LED lamp specifications, we're trying to make sure those are included. E17, the intermediate base, as I said before, we want to make sure that those are included. We got a lot of feedback on that. The G10 base was not included in draft one. Reason being that's normally associated with the anti-K shape. Let's try that again. The GU10 base is normally associated with an MR16, the line voltage MR16. We can talk about that more, but right now there is a lack of an ANSI standard MOL on that. And so that's one hurdle. The other hurdle is the center beam candle power tool that we have was not designed for line voltage, for line voltage MR16 shape, so that's the second hurdle. So that's why that was not in there. The ANSI-K shape, same problem, doesn't have an ANSI-MOL associated with it, so that's why that was not proposed in draft one. To the extent that improvements in R&D can make integrated ceramic metal halide a valid option, if issues with restrike and so on can be overcome, which we understand they can be, it's just a question of whether the market wants it. To the extent that that is possible, our plan is to incorporate the appropriate reference documents in a future draft. Low-voltage lamps, for example, MR16 lamps, were not proposed in draft one. We've faced numerous problems with these using the current LED lamp specification. One of them is savings is highly dependent on user behavior. It's highly dependent on the loading of the transformer. If the old magnetic transformer is left in place, if the new electronic transformer is put in place, it's very much the savings is dependent on the user behavior, not attributable to the product alone. So I think I've covered that, yeah.
Alex Evars from Lighting Science. The current MR16s that are qualified, are they going to be remaining until the draft gets released?
So the way that this would work is much the same as the luminaire specification. We would finalize the spec after multiple drafts, transition period where we phase out the old specifications and phase in the new specifications. So once the effective date is reached of the new spec, lamps would need to be qualified and certified to that new specification in order to remain Energy Star qualified. So what that means practically is that if we end up with an effective date in spring or summer of next year, then probably you're looking at sometime late 2012 for an effective date, something along those lines. We haven't put out an effective date or even proposed one yet. Scott?
And Scott Reese-Bosch from CRS Electronics. What about manufacturers that have multiple MR16s under test and could take until the effective date or even later before they finish significant investments in testing, does that just get, I guess, wasted?
Well,
could you repeat the question?
The question was, what about testing that's existing on current MR16 models that are being tested for the existing specification? We should probably talk about that face-to-face just so I can have a better understanding of where you're at with that, but the way that the program operates generally is when a new specification goes into place, products need to meet the scope and the requirements of that new spec in order to remain qualified.
So this is WS from Nexus Lighting. Not to belabor the point, but I do think it's a valid concern in terms of first and second generation of MR16 lamps, or maybe even third generation of MR16 lamps that are either in testing, that are already on the spec. I mean, this is a significant portion of product offering that consumers are buying.
So why don't we make that an item for the parking lot? Because I think we've got
the parking lot.
Sure. Okay. So that's our first item for the parking lot. Do you have a clarifying question?
Aaron Fite. You have the same situation with non-standard LED lamps, non-standard regular lamps that are now out of the spec, but were put back into the spec a year ago, and many people have those lamps testing.
Yeah. Okay, so what do you want to add, man's non-standards and
what
and GU10.
The manufacturer name,
but
it's tied to the data.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Another issue that we've run into over and over again, there was a lot of talk about this in the press, is the performance of the lamp is highly dependent on what type of system the consumer is operating on, whether it's an AC system, AC transformer or DC transformer is going to affect how much light they get out of the lamp. And finally, the form factor makes it difficult or near impossible to enforce lamp labeling requirements. In order to educate the consumer on replacement to buy the next lamp after that one. For non-standard lamps, we seek input on an approach to labeling these lamps, recognizing that solid-state lamps, you know, it's a different type of technology. It's directional. We don't necessarily need to continue to grab on to anti-shapes in order to get high-performing lamps. So we do recognize there's a lot of potential in the non-standard category, but that said, we need to find a sensible way to implement this. Self-valves and CFLs, we recognize those are not designed to conform to ANSI standards, and we are reevaluating the non-standard provisions that are in the integral LED lamps specification. So, top level, this is what we have in place right now for non-standard lamps. Non-standard lamps are not allowed to stay equivalency to existing standard electric lamps in terms of wattage or shape. There's a system of iconography that needs to be employed. This was implemented in version 1.4 on the box in order to inform the consumer about what types of applications the non-standard lamp would be good for. And so using that system of icons, the ones that it is appropriate for, you would circle, and the ones that it's not, you would put an X in. The chart here is just a photograph from the from the existing specification, it sort of points out the deficiency that we have right now. It's really one set of efficacy levels that's intended to apply to a whole range of non-standard shapes. It's difficult to ascertain if it's really appropriate to have one efficacy level for the many types of shapes that non-standard lamps could hold. A single minimum light output requirement is not necessarily guaranteed to provide consumers what it is that they're looking for. There are also no luminous intensity distribution requirements presently. The effective date, we don't have an effective date proposed yet. To qualify Energy Star, this is a standard boilerplate language, the product model shall meet the Energy Star specification in effect on its date of manufacture, and the date of manufacture is specific to each unit and is the exact date on which a unit is considered to be completely assembled. What that means is that until the existing specifications are sunset, for lack of a better word, a manufacturer would be able to continue manufacturing using that specification until that spec is no longer in place. Excuse me. For product families, we recognize that we have the same motivation as you guys to try to the greatest extent possible, reduce testing burden. So that you guys can bring as much product to market as possible. Your market share is also our market share, so we want to try to find ways that will minimize the amount of testing. So if you test this, to what extent can the testing for this apply to that lamp? So we're seeking input on this. We had some conversations with folks at the partner meeting who are busy developing some proposals that we'll send our way. I'm going to pass this off now to Dave Ryan, who's going to go through the photometric performance requirements.
For those of you who don't know me, quick introduction. DNR International was a longtime contractor for the DOE on the support of the TFL and ILL specifications, our integral LED lamp. So Sorry about that. We've been supporting Alex and his team on the analysis that's going into some of the proposed levels. So I'm going to click through the photometric performance requirements that have been proposed and go through some of the analysis that we've been on. They're going to make all the decisions. So, quick note, as we go through some of these slides, I'll note what the requirement is and also what the passing criteria are. All of the photometric requirements are based on a sample size of 10 lamps. This is the same sample size that exists in the current CFL criteria and the same sample size that exists in the current hydrology criteria. So hopefully it's not surprising enough. All right, so these are the proposed efficacy requirements. As you can see, if you're very familiar with the CFL and Israeli VLAN specifications, we streamline these values a bit. We have fewer bins. There's fewer wattage bins. There's fewer product type bins. It's broken down to omnidirectional, directional, and decorative, less than and greater than 10 watts. The levels themselves actually don't represent a large increase in efficacy. As Alex mentioned early in the presentation, we're very much focused on those consumer dissatisfiers, and whereas we're trying to get some tighter specifications on those parameters, we didn't feel that it was justified to tighten or to raise these specifications as well. Because they've been streamlined, there are some particular types of lamps that you can point to where the lumens per watt have been increased, but for the most part, it's pretty consistent with what has been the case in the past. For example, the highest efficacy bin on the CFL specification is actually 65 lumens per watt, and for here, the highest bin is only 60 lumens per watt. So, we did analysis of all the qualifying products based on the data that DNR had collected through the end of 2010 when we had qualifying products, as well as the data provided from the certification bodies in 2011 for all of the lamp types, GU24, CFL, and integral LED lamps. And about 90% of the lamps in the omnidirectional category met the proposed criteria. Similar in the directional category, for decorative lamps, it was about 85%. So we capture quite a bit of the existing product line, not even considering the improvements that are being made in efficiencies, particularly in the LED space. So this is a graphical representation of the omnidirectional lamp efficacy requirements. The scatter plot are the various types of lamps that are qualified through CDs and prior to that through DNR and ICF. As you can see, there's a large majority of the products that pass. There are a few that drop off, but they tend to be on the integral LED lamp side where there are consistent improvements being made and really the from some of the older products in the data set. Similarly, here is the same chart for directional lamps. It's interesting to note that almost all of the integral LED lamps that were considered directional passed the criteria that have been proposed. Most of the CFLs and GU24s do as well, although there are, again, a few products that do not. And finally, the decorative lamps at two levels and the same scatter plot with weather, blah, blah, blah. So. All right, the next category on. Yeah, I'm sorry. If I miss your question, just make sure to wave at me. So, yeah.
This is Tematic from Crete. One of the questions that I had, if you go back to the original slide there with the requirement,
yep.
You define the wattages. Is that intended to be the safety rating of the product? Or, you know, we may have something that's safety rated for 9.9 watts, but when you take into account the UL tolerances, you know, we could be anywhere from 8.9 to 11 point something.
Yeah, that's a good point, and if you would please include that in your comments.
Okay.
We'll address that.
Okay.
I should mention that. True through that yet. In the past, it has been the nominal wattage of the product. So if the product was a 10-watt product on the packaging, that's what it was based on, but that hasn't been determined for this spec.
Can you still hear me in the back?
No. Yeah, you know, when I talk into this microphone, it overrides, so I'm going to stop talking into this microphone. But I think we failed to tell folks on the phone that we have them muted just to minimize background noise. And folks who have a question on the phone, if you would please hit the raise your hand button or enter a question, and we'll come back to it later in the presentation.
Aaron Fight, Fight Electric. The passing requirements on the chart are in conflict with the FTC regulations. The FTC regulations say base up, base down. You take the base down, you
take the base down if it's lower, and that's the lumens you use, or you use the base up and you have to mark maybe more than 5% lower in the base down position. That's the average cannot be used according to the FCC.
So the requirement here is you have to test 5 days up and 5 days down, and it's whichever average of the two is lesser is what needs to meet the criteria.
Right, and that's in conflict with the FTC.
But
that's a test you have to do for the FTC. So I'm just thinking we need to coordinate the FTC regulations with the Energy Star regulations.
Ultimately, you're running one set of tests, right, and then it's a number of calculations. So perhaps one calculation for FTC's purposes and one calculation for our program's purposes.
And then packaging conflict.
Okay. I think we've got direction already on the packaging conflict, which we made into an FAQ, but we can talk about that offline.
Andrew, did you have a...
In almost all cases, you're going to the sales desk as long as you have the... So the FTC refers to the CE standard, which is 5 days up, where an FTC 5 days up and 5 days on average. So in most cases, in almost all cases, you're going to fulfill their requirements for sample size. When it comes to the average, they accept the average of 10 samples because it exceeds their minimum requirements. If there's any specific examples that you might have that you think that are clear conflicts, we can absolutely explore them.
Okay. We have a lot of content to go through, so I think we're going to need to keep going.
Another quick, I think Jinjiao would ask, maybe folks already understood it, but just from a language standpoint of view, the efficacy number there, the list of precise number, really you meant it was minimum. You can certainly be higher than 55.1. So
that's
correct. So yeah, just for specification-wise, you should not use precise number. I'm assuming you meant minimum.
I think in the specification they say minimum efficacy. Okay. Any last clarifying questions on the efficacy levels? Okay. And again, if we have more comments on those, parking lot, I can come back to it later. But so the next metric that we look at is light output requirements. The light output requirements for all categories, omnidirectional, directional, and decorative, are tied with the equivalent incandescent wattage that you're claiming equivalency from. So the levels that are proposed are carried forward from the existing specifications. We did some analysis where we looked at catalog lumen information for incandescent lamps from the major manufacturers, and the standard trends, the means and the medians, all support these levels, so we don't propose on changing them. Yeah.
Jack for LED transformation, it's a little confusing. It says minimum light output, but I mean, a minimum is a minimum, and how do you have a range of minimal?
Okay, so the again, this may be just a language confusion. It's to claim that your lamp is an equivalent to a 40 watt lamp, for example, you have to produce a minimum of 450 lumens. But what we wanted to clarify was that if your lamp put out more than 800 lumens, you could not then claim that it was a 40 watt equivalent, right? So you would have to claim that it was a 60 watt.
It'll prompt you.
The ranges come in. Maybe light output.
You can't extrapolate to 50 watts equivalent anymore. Where you could before.
For omnidirectional lamps, I don't believe you could ever extrapolate to 50 watt equivalent. It was always based on the standard nominal wattages that were found in common incandescent lamps. You could do that for some of the directional lamp categories, but not for omnidirectional.
One of your points about CFO, but my understanding on the CFO spec is, you have to have a certain minimum light output to be able to call it incandescent equivalent. The way I read the new spec is that your actual light output has to comply with that, the measured light output. Is that, am I interpreting that wrong? Or?
No. This is what your light output has to be, but what your light output has to be is tied with what the equivalent that you're claiming the lamp to be is.
Right. But previously for CFLs, it was the rating on the package, and at like for 100 watt, you had to have 1,600 lumens to be able to call it 100 watt equivalent. And now what you're saying, they're actually the actual measured value has to be in this range or whatever to call it 100 watt equivalent.
I think that's consistent with what we were doing before. You couldn't claim it was 1,600 lumens before if it was less than 1,600 lumens.
I'm not saying that anyone would do that, but I don't think that was that actual check. As far as I was aware, you only had a lumen per watt requirement, not a lumen requirement. Maybe you guys were checking it on the back end, but I never saw anything on the spec.
The way the spec was always determined in the past is that to claim 100 watt equivalent, you had to be putting out 1600 lumens of light. So that's the same requirement. It may be just for a slightly different menu.
How many followers does it find in this? Could we theoretically have a 405 lumen output considered a 40 watt equivalent with a 10%?
Tolerance is we didn't address in draft one.
Okay.
Excellent question.
Well, I can tell you at the moment.
Okay. Noah.
Noah Horowitz, NRDC, real quick. I think some confusion that hopefully we can avoid through the meeting is when we're talking about a rated value versus actual measured value, which I think is partially what we were getting into before.
Similarly, we have now specific layout requirements for globes. Previously, globes were considered a decorative lamp. EPA determined that, or is proposing that, since globes have a significant illumination function as well, particularly in bathroom vanities and so forth, that they have to have layout requirements for that category specifically, and will be considered an omnidirectional lamp, or supposed to be considered an omnidirectional lamp. So, similarly, we did analysis of lumen output for manufacturers, came up with proposed levels for globes. So, these are the proposed levels. Directional lamps. Directional lamps in the CFL specification do not have a specific layout requirement. In the ISRO LED lamp specification, the requirement was that they provide 10 times the number of lumens as the equivalent wattage that they were claiming. So if they were claiming a 40-watt equivalent, they had to put out 400 lumens. This was very linear and doesn't take into account that as wattage goes up, efficacy also increases. You can have more lumens split for those higher wattage bulbs. So this is something for draft 2 that we intend on populating with proposed levels. Obviously, if anyone has data on this that they would like to share with us, that would be very valuable for us. For decorative lamps, similarly, proposed levels. I suppose I should mention on the decorative directional lamps, rather, that this does not apply to par lamps. There's a lumen intensity distribution requirement specifically for par lamps that we'll get into later in the presentation. All right, correlated color temperature requirements. EPA is proposing that as part of the new integrated lamp specification that we limit the CCTs to less than or 5,000 K, eliminating the high 5,700 and 6,500 K lamps. Also proposes re-tightening the bins back to the four-step elliptic. The idea behind this was that the original, there's several ideas behind this, but the original ANSI G78.376 proposed a four-step ellipse as the standard. In the criteria setting process for the CFL program and for the RLF program, that eventually got expanded to seven steps. EPA is proposing to return to that four-step to be consistent with the standard. The other reasons are that from a consumer satisfaction standpoint, the seven-step ellipse, it was felt, can sometimes allow for overly green-tinted or magenta-tinted lamps, and that was undesirable. And also allowed for large variation between models, between manufacturers, even on something that was a nominally the same CCT. So four-step ellipse limits that variation and therefore promotes idea is to promote consumer satisfaction. So these are the proposed levels. This is a quick diagram of the ANSI ellipses. And as you can see, that the clock angles that were defined in 377 and the ellipses that were defined in 376 don't always target the same impact. So in harmonizing around one of those two things, come up with a technology-neutral color specification. We've gone with a four-step ellipses or corresponding quadrangles around those 376 ellipses. So that's what's been proposed. There is quite a bit of recognition. There's a couple slides on this, so if you let me get through it, and then I'll take clarifying questions because I may answer them. But there's a recognition from EPA that this limits the number of lamps currently qualified that will meet the new criteria. As you can see, there's 45% of lamps that are currently qualified that are inside the four-step ellipse. This is one of those places where, because they're not looking to push advocacy, they're looking to address those consumer dissatisfiers, it felt like this could be proposed and to see what the question was. There was some manufacturer support for this in the response to the framework document that was published in early 2011. So the other 2 points here just reiterate what I said before about the quadrangles allowing for magenta and green tinted lamps, and the hope is to improve consistency and improve consumer satisfaction. So this is the impact on CFLs that will have on the existing criteria, or the existing qualified product list. Similarly, these charts are scatter plots of how it will affect the integral LED lamp category. Because, particularly at 3000K, the sensors were not aligned between 377 and 376, it does have a sort of larger effect on that category. But the number of lamps on that the technology is more in the developmental stage. Again, this proposal that we try and encourage consistency across the consumer goes to pick out 3,000 lamps, they will have a consistent experience with that. We did actually light there that the limiting to four-step ellipses was going to cause an increase in the cost of extraction, particularly in the price of the phosphor. We did some very cursory analysis trying to find anecdotal evidence to see whether that was true. Very difficult to do pricing analysis on lamps because there are so many factors that affect the price of lamps, whether it's the CCT, whether it's the retailer that carries through, the manufacturer that makes them, the incentive pricing that's in place around utilities. So we very much encourage, if you feel that this is going to drastically impact the cost of your manufacturing, the cost of your lamps, we need data to substantiate that. So that's sort of one of our formal requests to the manufacturing industry community, is that this is a major impact on the price, and we would like to see data for how that is going to come through. So that's my last slide on CCP. As you can see, Alex has already parking lot this later discussion. But does anyone have any clarifying questions on this topic? So what we're proposing.
Chad, start with Philip Sumaled's question. I see 4,000, then I see 4,100 referenced in different ways. How are we supposed to interpret that?
I don't think you want to address that, but I'm saying that 4,100 versus 4,000.
It's what you call it, but look at the answer standard. It's the same bin. It's just whether you choose to print 4,000 Kelvin or 4,100 Kelvin on the package.
And okay. At this point, we're agnostic to what the name of that bin is. We are identifying that bin is one of the allowed CCTs.
Okay. That's why I figured that might be the reason, but we wanted to understand it.
Okay. But where is the four-step ellipse drawn?
The four-step ellipse is drawn around the fluorescent standard, the 376 ellipse. And the four-step ellipse around that, and it's the corresponding quadrangle to that ellipse, which is being proposed as what the standard is for integral LED. So it's the same tolerance, is just because the two technologies have slightly different ways of evaluating them. That's where we're setting the goal.
And we acknowledge that the 2012 revision of 377 is not intended to redirect the industry toward four steps, but it won't. But there is a chart placed in there for technology. So it adds a linkage between the old fluorescent standard and the 2012.
And again, because EPA is interested in a technology neutral approach where there's consistent colors, we have CFL or an neutral LED lamp, if they're the same nominal color temperature, if there's some consistency between that color temperature, they had to pick one for both. So
that's actually it. Lighting signs for LED lamps, 5,000K is new. For energy star qualifications, we address testing on that in the parking lot. Future discussion.
Testing 5,000 Kelvin?
Yes.
Tianjin was 1,000 upsell. You're aware of what we're developing for this reference system. And I feel that four steps references that reference with the linear fluorescent lamps, they're not centered on the seven steps. Your current specification allows like two of them of four steps, but no more than seven steps. But they're not called centered. They're two different locations. So if you consider four steps, the question is where we want them.
Yeah, we'll return to that part. So unless there are any other clarifying questions on this, yes, please say anything.
Sora, is there any, I guess, are the lamps intended to be tested at full power on a dimmer switch LED system? Is there a tolerance or tolerance?
Sora,
please
draw around.
All right, moving on from CCT, next metric is CRI. EPA essentially proposes maintaining the current CRI requirements, an RA of 80 or better and an R9 of greater than zero. We recognize that CFL didn't have to meet the R9 requirements specifically beforehand. However, the integral of UMAPs do, and there was seen as some value in having a positive R9, so we've included that. We also, in a number of places, have included proposals for backstopping what the requirements are. The requirements historically have been average requirements, so we also wanted to make sure that there wasn't too large a deviation from that average. So we proposed that of the 10 samples, no more than 3 can have an RA less than 77, and none of the units can have an RA less than 75. So, clarifying questions? All right, moving on. This is a breakdown of the color rendering index of existing CFLs and GU24s. As you can see, it's very heavily weighted towards just above 80. EPA did consider for some time whether it was worthwhile to increase the CRI requirement. It was felt that to have a meaningful increase, you'd have to increase it to a point where none of the existing lamps would basically qualify. So it wasn't proposed to do that in this term. Color maintenance. The current requirement for color maintenance is that integral LED lamps have to maintain a color consistency less, where the movement is less than 0.007. Consistent with the change to a four-step ellipse from a seven-step ellipse, we are trying to tighten overall, or proposing tightening overall, the color characteristics of these lamps. So similarly, the drift has proposed to be moved from 0.007 to 0.004. And then along with that, color angular uniformity is having the same proposed change to maybe 0.004 away. So this is not a change, but it's considered. So, my questions on maintenance or uniformity.
You know what, Margie, right now, most of this is BS you don't need to know.
Do I hang up?
I don't know what right off the top of my head.
Okay, I'll type it to you.
Go back.
I'm trying.
Hi, I'm Walt. I'll alert you if anything shows that I
can. For everyone on the phone, please mute your phones.
The requirement for integral LED lamps up to this point has always been at least 6,000 hours of lamp operation. Alice is going to go through a whole section on lumen maintenance reliability where we talk about the long-term testing and what we're proposing. But
to answer your question directly,
yes, it has to be for 6,000 hours of operation. Yeah. Other clarifying questions? All right.
One more. Back on Hakaran and Lutron, go back to that slide. It says at any measurement point during the first 6,000 hours.
That's
so
right.
How many measurement points do you have to take?
This, again, will be discussed in a little more detail in the luminance maintenance reliability section, but I believe for integral LED lamps, the requirement is at 0, 3,000 hours, and 6,000 hours. So, 3,000. So, we're going to go 2.
Jim, sorry, Phillips. If the lifetime is dropped from 25,000 to 10,000, shouldn't the testing time also be decreased?
I think the best place to address that is in the lumen maintenance reliability section.
Just quick, do you by chance?
Jianqiao with Azure Opto, if you have any data to support that 3,000, 6,000 hours, but that kind of color misses information to validify that color.
The 3,000, 6,000 hour measurement points are consistent with the current integral LED lamp specification.
Correct.
And
data to show that tolerance being met.
We don't have specific data on that point.
We have some. We have some. It was the original integral LED lamp specification only pointed to the lumen maintenance, the chromaticity shift at the 6,000 measurement, 6,000 hour measurement point, but we have some data at the 3,000 measurement point, and so we do have some of that data that we look at in this. And I will say that there have been some situations where a product does not meet the color maintenance at 3,000 hour measurement, but it does at 6,000 hour. And, you know, that can be up for discussion of whether that's acceptable to the consumers if there is that shift.
Right. The best scenario is when Alex earlier presented the data in terms of the product status. If you have that data,
we don't have it for a large number of products.
So again, we have parking lot of this topic, so we can return to it. But unless there are other clarifying questions, I think might be.
I think my role from Spectronics. If we go back to the fault types, macanamics, can we still refer to the NCT28327?
That's being worked on right now would include, correct me if I'm wrong on this, would include an annex that has the data in it. So the current 2008 version does not include it, but the 2012 version would. Do I have that right?
No, it's somewhat incorrect because the fourth step was not standard with anything related to our original document. That was purely for the reference of the linear fluorescent lamp. So they're off standard.
At all CCTs?
Yes.
So it's definitely a larger discussion that we need to have and potentially something that, you know, maybe even beyond this, beyond today's discussion.
And I'll mention, Dr. Gow, that we would have that data at the LME level, but not necessarily, this is Taylor J. Pelosi. We will have it for majority of LED lamps at the LME level, but for a smaller, much smaller sample at the lamp level itself.
And so we have received some feedback from people on the phone that they have trouble hearing sometimes, so I think everyone can see the microphones. So when you're asking a question, if you could try and project your voice a little bit, I'll do a little bit better job walking around the microphone during this thing.
You heard try to slow the speech down a little bit too. Sorry, folks on the phone are seeing your questions now. So how do we mute all of the... What's the number I punch in?
All guests have been muted.
All right. Sorry for the delay, folks. Hope that helps with folks on the phone. Okay, so this can get really boring, huh? It's kind of tedious, all this stuff, so I'm going to take it to a different direction. Lindsay, my presentation called One is the Meaning of Life. So what we proposed, and you know, I started to dabble on this in the at the partner meeting this year, but we, you know, for a few years now, we've been working with 15,000 hour and 25,000 hour requirements for LED lamps. And so the question is, does that serve consumer needs? I think there was general recognition that early on to get utilities in particular engaged on the topic that they would want to see a demonstration that this technology really can last. I think we've demonstrated that the technology can last, but the question still is outstanding, what does the consumer want, I think. Especially if you go look at the price points on the shelves, they're not exactly flying off the shelves, as far as we can tell. So this is just sort of a loose discussion. We're trying to kick off a discussion with our proposal in draft one. So here we go. So the current life requirements in the CFL version 4.2 specification, 8,000 hours for bare cover globe outdoor reflectors, 6,000 hours for indoor reflectors,
Integral LED lamp spec, again, 15,000 hours for decorative and 25,000 hours for omnidirectional, directional, and non-standard. Chad Sauger.
Alex, Chad Sauger, Philips Lumileds. What's the definition of light for CFL version 4.2? Do they fail?
A fine question, so we'll get into that.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so that's what we have right now. By the hours, this is how this breaks down. So the lowly incandescent lamp, whether that is a standard incandescent that is slowly going away, general service, 100 watts or lower, or the halogen incandescent that are ISO compliant, our understanding is they're all going to be 1,000 hours. So there you have it, 1,000 hours. For the consumer, that means that about, it's going to last most of the year. In the commercial phase, these lamps obviously don't make any sense because of maintenance costs. 8,000 hours for the consumer, assuming that the lamp does meet up to its rating, 7.3 years, and in the commercial space, 1.8 years. 15,000 hours. Does the consumer want a lamp to last 14 years? That is the question. Likewise, 25,000 hours, which is the bulk of what we're labeling, which covers the bulk of what we're labeling with the integral LED lamp spec, 25,000 hours is nearly 23 years. Is that what the consumer wants? And that's really sort of the question. We know that these elongated lifetimes are very useful in the commercial space because of maintenance costs, because of the inconvenience of setting up scaffolding, things like that. But for the consumer, it's really a question of, does this make sense? So what lasts 14 or 23 years? In the home, the things that we buy that we call durable goods or parked outside our homes, appliances, home HVAC, cars. So these are things that we use for an hour or so a day. Granted, HVAC is maybe a slightly different category, but yes, for durable goods, we expect that these products will last for these types of time frames. Do we expect light bulbs to last this long? That's the question. Do consumers want that? Portable audio. Who's still using their Walkman? Who's still using their Discman? Technology changes. Nobody's using the same cell phone anymore because you want the latest and greatest. Light bulbs, do we really want to have the same old light bulb 23 years later? Computers, nobody here is using the same laptop from 14 years ago, desktop, tablet. Televisions, I would hazard a guess that 14 years is probably on the upper end of how long you're going to have a TV before you replace it. Same for computer monitors. So it's a question of, are we going to peg light bulbs to have the same performance as all these other goods? Do they become durable goods, and why? And what's the justification for that? Particularly when we look at the DOE roadmap. So just splitting the difference here, just for the sake of round numbers, if you look at the warm white data, splitting 96 and 141, let's just call it 120. If you look at that compared to what we anticipate is possible by 2020, we're only halfway there. So I think that the argument that that setting us back now at whatever level we set, there really are only going to be a few watts left to get, and it's not worth trying to capture those, I'm not sure that that's necessarily true. We're really, really interested in everyone's opinion on this, particularly from everyone, from the manufacturers to the retailers to the utilities, everybody on the topic. We'd like to know what you think. But if you look at this and you accept solid-state lighting has a lot of potential, why do we want to put the consumer using a lamp that they're going to have in place for, at today's efficacy levels, for 14, 23 years or so? At the partner meeting, I received a lot of feedback on the 10,000-hour proposal. One comment that I received was it's sort of a dumbing down of the technology. It's really, from my perspective, a question of quality. What do we fold into the word quality? So efficacy, we accept that these are things that are important to us from a quality standpoint, and this is the reason that ENERGY STAR specifications have so many different requirements in them. Efficacy is important. If we were only pegged to efficacy, then we would have, say, street lighting in our table lamps in the living room. So the other things are important, too. Light output, color, is it consistent? Does it maintain good color output over time? Are objects well rendered in terms of color? Flicker, we don't want flicker, we don't want noise. Longevity, do we fold longevity into what we call quality? And if so, then do we say that standard incandescent and halogen incandescent are low quality because they only last 1,000 hours? I mean, I think there's general recognition that standard incandescent and halogen incandescent pretty much gives you everything you want in terms of quality, but we know that it has drawbacks in terms of efficiency or efficacy. So it's really just sort of a question of what are we trying to go after here for the consumer. Does the consumer want a 14-year lamp? Do they want a 23-year lamp? Does LED initial cost seem to be a barrier today? I have my opinions on this, but these are questions that I think everyone needs to be asking themselves in terms of what we need in our spec. Does it make sense to sell consumers today's efficacy levels and tell them that they should be satisfied with that for the next decade or two, or three? Would consumers appreciate improvements in LED performance over time? The color improving, the efficacy of improving, the consistency of improving, would they appreciate that? So about the 10,000-hour proposal, this is just top level. It's a minimum. It's a minimum requirement. We don't think that there's really going to be a race for manufacturers to re-engineer, a race to the bottom. We don't think that's likely. Maybe it is, and all the manufacturers need to discuss among themselves. We think it's likely to lower initial costs. And in numerous conversations we had with LED lamp manufacturers at the partner meeting, they were pretty confident that, yes, they would be able to bring lower-cost 10,000-hour lamps to market if it was only 10,000 hours. The next bulb is likely to be cheaper and higher efficacy than today's. Consumers don't necessarily believe or understand these elongated claims. That's been the case now with CFLs. And I think that's extending to LEDs as well. And consumers don't have $30 for a light bulb. So, and especially when it's on the same shelf next to the $1 CFL. So these are just sort of some high-level thoughts. And now we'll get back into the nitty-gritty of the specification.
Your last point, consumers don't want a $30 light bulb. Have you guys done market surveys, studies? What is your data?
Data is, to a large extent, it's anecdotal, but we would certainly benefit from some data to show either way what's going on with that. If folks who aren't aware, we're not unable to do focus groups. The government's not able to do that, so we do sort of rely on data from our partners on this topic. But if you take a look at the shelves, they don't seem to be exactly flying off the shelf. The price points are coming down for sure, but what I've noticed is the price points are coming down on products that aren't necessarily ENERGY STAR qualified, so we don't know if they're meeting all the quality thresholds that we have in our spec. So we would certainly benefit from some more data. Taylor?
I will say that from discussions with retailers in terms of product price and movement, a lot of they move slow at their full price when they're rebated in the spec. So that shows the cost differential and where the hot spot is. It's at like $10 range. But so it's some of the evidence is from retailers.
Alex Bozenberg, NEMA. It's still anecdotal, but you might reach out to Lowe's and Home Depot. If nothing else, I can say in my own observation in the last 6 months, LED SSL replacement lamps, screw-based stuff, has gone from one shelf to an entire rack, if not two. Whether or not they're selling, they're obvious demand, or Lowe's wouldn't put them there.
It's certainly a question that we have to continue to engage some of the retail merchants and tailors on the phone practically daily with them talking about these topics.
If I can make another point about the whole mini presentation there is really sort of philosophical, where are we coming from, let's try and get some discussion going. We can return to the philosophy in the parking lot and on, but there's a lot more detail on what we're proposing in the next few slides that Alex is going to present. So.
Aaron, a clarifying question?
I just want to understand how you clarify that there's going to be a major price difference between a 10,000-hour lamp and a 25,000-hour lamp. My research has told me that the only thing that you could possibly save would be on the amount of LEDs, because you could overdrive LEDs to meet the lumens. Nothing else, as far as I'm concerned, would change unless you really lowered the quality. And to go back to the old Edison days of building in obsolescence, I think is not the right thing to do. And my research has shown us, and we've done focuses on it, that the main reason people buy CFLs and the main reason they buy LED lamps is because of long life.
Okay. It'd be really useful if you could share any data along those lines. To be clear, our intention is not planned obsolete. Our intention here is to be thoughtful about what it is that we're giving consumers now, knowing that we can give them something better longer term. So it's sort of a question of what does the consumer want, and recognizing also that we're proposing a minimum here. Partners can go ahead and continue to sell qualified long life bulbs, and I think there's room in the market for, I'm just using round numbers here, and of course there are some assumptions built in here, but if I think there's room in the market for a $10, 10,000 hour bulb, the $30, 30,000 hour bulb, and a $50 bulb, all of them Energy Star qualified, all of them meeting all of the other performance requirements, and the consumer can decide what it is that they need depending on the application. So their 20-foot ceiling, if they want the $50, 50,000-hour bulb, then that would be...
But the pricing's not that. There is no pricing differential like that.
Okay. The answer to that is highly dependent on the manufacturer. I've heard that. I've heard quite the opposite from other manufacturers.
Philip Permister, Mass Path Optics. If you use less LEDs, the LED components are obviously a significant cost component. You can have reduced cost. And the problem is that you're also going to be overdriving the LEDs, and you've probably failed the 60 lumen per watt efficacy at that point.
Certainly, it would need to be backed up with test data. Just using round numbers again, if you're using 6 LEDs and driving them at 350 milliamps versus using 3 LEDs and driving them at 750 milliamps, I know that's not a linear relationship, but if that were possible and the driver were able to be downsized as a result, that's what we need feedback on.
I think 750 at 700 milliamps, I don't think you're going to meet the efficacy requirements.
Okay. And I grant you, I think it's probably also highly dependent on thermal heat sinking, probably dependent on which LED you're using. But this is certainly something I think we need to send to the parking lot, because we have a lot more content that we have to go through here.
It's Jim Gaines. It's not only the efficacy that will be stressed by driving the harder, but also meeting these four-step changes, because temperature change, more stress on the LED, all those things are going to be harder to meet if you overdrive the LEDs.
Okay, so certainly an item for the parking lot later. Philosophy of life, excellent. Okay, so this is what we have proposed in draft one. We're recognizing that the conventions for testing CFLs and solid state, Chad, this is to your question, are different. In CFLs, the way that you establish life is you burn... you operate the lamps until 50% of them fail, and at that hour, that is your rated life, or that is what you've measured for life. Solid state, we don't operate the lamps until half of them fail. That would be impractical. We recognize that technology is moving very quickly, and so we need to try to keep pace with that. So with CFLs, the requirements are you need to maintain 80% of the lumens at 40% of the rated life. We have proposed to eliminate the 1,000-hour measurement, and we're going to get into more detail. This is one of these things that has multiple slides. For solid state, we're maintaining the existing requirements while also providing this option for a reduced rated lumen maintenance life of 10,000 hours. Partners will be enabled to use TM21 for the early interim qualification. I'll have another slide on that. For reliability requirements, life is a sticky subject. How do I expand on that? Using the term life when you're not actually testing the lamps until half of them fail is something that can be somewhat uncomfortable for us. So we're latching on to the term reliability. So we propose that lamps need to have greater than or equal to a 10,000 hour rated life. And the analysis has demonstrated that year after year, 10,000 hours is very feasible for CFLs.
We do recognize, of course, that the proposed changes would require retesting of most lamps, but we do want to point out to you that this would be required anyway. The requirement for retesting has been eliminated or will be eliminated in the CFL specification. We put out a letter about a month and a half ago to that effect. And likewise for the integral LED lamp spec, we're not going to get that far down the road with that spec before the new spec comes into place. So testing would be required anyway, even under the old, retesting would be required even under the old specifications.
Clarification. You said that most of the lamps would meet 10,000 hours CFL. Is that what you said?
No, I've got some other chart. I didn't
say the chart before, I think you wrote that 10,000 hours is highly feasible for CFLs. So have you done data on that and the difference between covered lamps and bare lamps?
Yeah, we have data.
Okay.
Here we go. So we've also proposed an extension of the elevator temperature test to all lamps, 5 watts or greater. This is a test that was originally required for indoor reflector lamps. We propose to require this of all lamps to evaluate the robustness of lamps in various thermal environments. The fact is that you can have a spiral CFL that is marketed as useful in a recessed pan. It could be an airtight recessed pan, where a specification didn't reflect any testing to account for that type of scenario. It's also a reflection of the fact that consumers very often don't apply the right CFL in the right application. So even if you may have a recessed pan that was designed originally for an A lamp, but if the consumer put a screw-based CFL into there that was really designed for a table lamp, that lamp is likely to fail early. So we're trying to improve the consumer experience. This all comes back to not ratcheting up efficacy levels too much, but really trying to address consumer dissatisfiers. And I think most in this room would probably acknowledge that there are a lot of consumers out there who are questioning the longevity claims of CFLs. And I think in this room, we probably have the understanding generally that that's very, very often because the consumer is putting the wrong lamp in the wrong application.
David from GE, I'd like to put this in the parking lot, but for
sure. For testing draft 2, this is a minor point. We're going to annex the elevator temperature test procedure so that accreditation bodies are able to accredit to it.
Joe Gallant from Selena. A lot of lamps are specifically marked on the left not for use in enclosed fixtures. Is the intent to test require those to be tested in elevated temperature regardless?
It's our sense that consumers are not picking up on that. There's a lot of information on packaging.
They ignore it all the time.
Exactly. And so I think what's happening, it seems to be evident that what's happening is that consumers will have that sort of negative experience and then generalize that experience, even if it is essentially their fault for putting the wrong bulb in the wrong application. They'll generalize that negative experience to all CFLs. And then we face difficulty getting them to adopt CFLs for other applications.
Yeah. So the answer is yes. We're proposing at this point that all lamps greater than 5 watts be tested under the high heat, one of the high heat testing regimes, and there's 3 options, I think, at this point.
For lumen maintenance and reliability requirements, the sample size that's proposed is 10 units, 5 face up and 5 face down. Unless the manufacturer has restricted the specific use or position. And, of course, if it is restricted, then they should all be tested in that restricted position. What's proposed for lumen maintenance testing, for compact fluorescence, the lamp shall maintain 80% of initial lumen output at 40% of rated light. And so no more than 3 units may have lumen maintenance less than 75%. No units may have, we have a floor here, no units may have a lumen maintenance less than 70%. In terms of feasibility of evaluating the current qualifying product list, 80% is still very achievable. If we were to ratchet that up to 85%, it would have a dramatic effect on the qualifying product list as it stands today, and of course 90% the same. And I should mention, it's probably something we need to mention periodically throughout this, we need the feedback from the manufacturers to understand how taking all of these together factors into
the feasibility of product, price points, et cetera. So we've made these proposals on an individual product requirement basis, performance requirement basis. We need your feedback on how bringing them all together affects the design and build. So,
Alex, the data you just showed, bottom, is that based on submitted data for submitting for Energy Star approval, or is that based on the audit, Pearl, and previous audit data?
Based on qualifying product data.
Yeah, this is based on data from DNR's database and from CDs for qualification. We have feedback on this from the verification testing program that we've gone on so far. This is not a major failure point in the third-party testing program. So, to answer that question.
Do you have it broken down by covered and non-covered?
Yeah, we're going to get to this one. If you guys will bear with me, I'm going to keep going through the section and hopefully some of your questions will be answered. For Lumen maintenance for solid state, we are proposing to maintain the 3,000-hour early interim qualification option. So manufacturers be able to submit data after 3,000 hours. These are the minimum lumen maintenance values that would need to be maintained at these various life claims. The products would then continue, or the lamps would continue to be tested out to 6,000 hours to establish full qualification. So at 3,000 hours, an LM79 report, LM80 report, 6,000 hour LM80 report, using the TM21 calculator, we would establish that the requirements have been met at that point, and then of course the in-situ temperature would need to be submitted as well in order to use the TM21 calculator. Please let me just go all the way through this, and then we'll get to the questions. The TM21 calculator, this is a brand new item. We elected, based on a conversation that we had with laboratories and certification bodies and accreditation bodies, we elected not to go down the road of accrediting to what is essentially a calculation. Instead, what we put together is an Excel spreadsheet. If anybody has concerns about us using Excel, it's not an endorsement. It's just we know everybody uses Excel, basically. So this calculator has been put together by DNR International. I sent it over to NIST. They've validated it, and we should be publishing it and putting it up on our website for everybody's use probably in the next week or two. So full qualification for solid-state lighting at 6,000 hours. These are the performance levels that would need to be met. With 6,000 hours of lamp-level data, you would be able to substantiate a maximum life claim of 10,000 to 25,000 hours. Any claims beyond 25,000 hours would require additional testing, which we'll show on the next slide. And so at 6,000 hours, another LM79 report would be submitted. This is really maintaining the existing, what's existing. And so this is the optional extended life claims. So in that chart there, that is the minimum test period required for each of these life claims and the lumen maintenance that would be required at the end of that, end of each of those tests. For reliability, this is all sort of one discussion, and solid state lighting makes it one discussion. For compact fluorescent lamps, lamps need to have a rated life of 10,000 hours or greater. All sensor units need to be operational at 40% of rated life or 6,000 hours, whichever comes first. And if the test intervals are coincident, which I believe occurred 15,000 hours, more than 90% of the test units shall be operational. This is what's proposed. And then 90% or more of the tested units need to be operational at 40% for 6,000 hours, whichever comes second. Finally, for compact fluorescent light, again, coming back to the definition of life in fluorescence, 50% of the units need to be operational at the rated life. For solid state, all the tested units shall be operational at 3,000 hours, and 90% or more of the lamps shall be operational at 6,000 hours. Our analysis of the existing qualifying product list shows that 100% of ILL's integral LED lamps would meet this requirement. 99% of qualified GU24 lamps currently meet this requirement, and 73% of qualified screw-based CFLs meet the criteria. And the average CFL lifetime has been increasing year over year, what's been submitted to the program. Aaron, this is the slide you're looking for. So
This is what has been qualified over the years in terms of lifetime. You can see that consistently since before 2006, 10,000 hour lamps have been achievable and have represented a sizable percentage of what's been qualified with the program. Likewise, 12,000 and 15, well, maybe not so much 15,000 hours, but you can also see that that there's a trend toward higher lifetime lifetime claims. 12,000 hours is increasing from 2008 to 2011. Aaron, this is specifically what you're looking for.
Right.
So all lamps in the first first column shows you 10,000 hours. This is CFL lamps. 10,000 hours comprises a sizable chunk of that. Same for omnidirectional. In the directional, there are fewer, and same for decorative. It may sort of point to a question of whether one technology is better than another. CFL, spiral CFL put into a reflector doesn't exactly give you much of a beam. It's sort of a big blob of light. So at any rate, these are the data for CFLs. 80% of omnidirectional CFLs are able to, currently qualified, are able to meet proposed criteria. 38% of directional CFLs and 44% of decorative CFLs. So why don't I stop there and see what questions there are.
If I can add on
to this as well. Remember, we were looking at lamps as a category. So CFLs is one component, GU24 is an ILL, are the other component. This isn't broken down for those two lamp categories, because basically every lamp, omnidirectional, directional, and decorative, met the 10,000-hour requirement in those categories. So it's a good thing to know. It looks like, you know, there's a lot of CFLs in the decorative or directional categories that don't meet, but there are also a lot of GU24 CFLs and ILLs in those categories, much more so than omnidirectional. So.
Clarify what JNGL was asking about. So, what do you intend to do using CM21 for what data to be calculated the projection?
LMAD data.
For LED sources only.
Yes, for the LED package array or module within the lamp at 3,000 hours using the in-situ temperature. We're not proposing to use CM21
at 3,000 hours.
Yeah.
And we have an early initial qualification. Maybe you should.
Yeah. I think this is based off of the current qualification regime or paradigm that we have for integral LED lamps and CFLs. It all builds off of that. So the current qualification system for ILLs basically is carried over into this. And so
at 3,000 hours
of lamp level testing, you can qualify your products. We call it early interim in this particular graph. I think before it's called early initial. And at 3,000 hours, you need 3,000 hours of lamp testing and 6,000 hours of device level testing, so LMA, right? And so the requirements for demonstrating that would project out to L70 of at least 10,000 hours, that the projections off of the LMA data, the device level data, are done by CNR law.
The combination of both. That's right.
And you have to satisfy both requirements, right?
It's really an extension of what's existing, except TM21 would replace a DOE project.
Right. The TM21 replaces the generic exponential decay that's been in place up to this point. So,
David from GE, I just want to add to your parking lot, lumen maintenance, especially for requirements specifically to 10,000 hours. I think testing up to 6,000 hours for a 10,000-hour product doesn't make sense.
And we'd be interested in alternate proposals that are technically defensible.
Yeah.
Okay. Sure.
You are. Hi, Ivar from Lighting Science. With solid state lighting, you're allowed one failure between 3,000 and 6,000 hours. We need some clarification on how to do the calculation. Do we eliminate that lamp in the calculation, or do we use it at zero?
If I didn't have that in the spec, we'll get it clarified in draft two. I think we use the term surviving lamps. 90% of the
surviving
lamps.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jack LED transformation. In the contact fluorescent one, you said for the lifetime, 50%, and you're starting with only a sample of 10 units. 50% had to be still working at the rated lifetime. Isn't that too small a population to assume that's going to happen every time?
It's the convention that's been established in the industry, and we're carrying it forward from the CFL specification.
Right, but that's for the industry. That's not a population of 10 units, is it?
So this is the existing qualification systems for Energy Star are based on a sample of 10 units. So that hasn't changed. I think it's a good question. And if you, in your comments you want to suggest that an additional sample size or the sample size increase, you know, we could talk about that. But that's the existing convention, and we don't propose changing that in the new spec.
It's worth mentioning that, you know, we are taking two specs and merging them together, but to the greatest extent possible, where we don't have to rock the boat and upset the existing systems, we don't want to. There is an existing infrastructure that we're trying to leverage, and, you know, we're trying to improve quality and improve the consumer experience, but from a testing standpoint, you know, we want to try to make it doable.
I'm 38% of directional meet the light, so you're telling all manufacturers, basically, or most manufacturers, to change their directional lamp.
Again, to clarify, this is 38% of directional CFLs.
Right, I'm talking about CFLs.
100% of directional GU24 CFLs meet it, and 100% of the integral LED lamps meet it. So when you look at the directional lamps as a category, a technology neutral across categories, that's what we're looking at. So it does disproportionately affect CFLs. As Alex made the point, maybe perhaps that speaks to the fact that perhaps CFLs in a directional category is not the ideal application of that technology, but that is the proposal at this point.
Okay. Hi, Noah Horowitz, NRDC. I just want to make sure I understood this properly. There's reliability, lifetime, lumen maintenance are all kind of intertwined here. So if I have 10 samples of a CFL, 5 base up, 5 base down, let's assume, do all 10 of them need to survive up to 40% of rated life, call it 10,000 hours, or at 4,000 hours, all of them need to still be functioning?
Yeah, so the proposal is that for CFLs of the sample of 10, at 40% of rated life, let's assume a lifetime less than 15,000 hours, at 40% of rated life, all 10 lamps must still be burning. That is actually a change. We currently allow for one failure, right? At 6,000 hours, one lamp can have failed. That's a change. Currently, there's no 6,000-hour requirements at all. And at full rated life, 10,000 hours, half can be have burned out. Does that answer?
In terms of lumen maintenance, then, at 40%, could you go to that requirement real quick?
Okay.
So lumen maintenance is 80% of
initial
output.
I want to know if everyone needs to meet it, or
it's the average of the remaining samples, the surviving samples.
But all of them have to survive to 40%.
All have to survive to 40%, that's correct.
Okay. So I don't need a parking ticket, I'm good.
Thanks. Tom Sonosora, is there a rationale behind the 80% lumen maintenance at 40% rate of life for CFL and 80% rate of life at 6,000 hours for LED?
So both of those are based on the established convention. CFLs typically test lumen maintenance at 40% of life. They also have been testing lumen maintenance at 1,000 hours of life. We're eliminating that, as Alex mentioned. CFL or LEDs have tested their lumen maintenance at 6,000 hours. That's the conventions that have been established, so that's what we propose carrying forward.
But I can easily turn off my test at 4,000.
Right. So the answer is we're in that circumstance, we're proposing to continue established convention. It may be worth discussing whether there's a lower testing requirement that should be considered. We have that in the parsing line. But right now we're proposing continuing the existing qualification regime.
These figures include the fact on the new specification, so that means that this percentage had no failures at 40%, the ones that are passed, or is this based on the old specifications where you could have one failure at 40%? You're saying
you need this slide in particular?
Right.
This slide is a reflection of what's qualified currently.
Right.
So it's not the new. So it could be worse because you could have out of that 38% of directional CFLs, you could have lamps that you consider pass that had one failure at 40%.
That's correct. We don't have that included in this.
So it's probably a lot worse than that.
It may be a little worse than
this. A lot worse.
I'll mention that just from looking at the data for the year, we have rare occurrences of failure at 40%. And actually, surprisingly, this is qualifying test data, not on the verification side. but majority of end of rated life, we have 80% or more samples still burning from what we've seen in qualified data. But very rarely do we have one or two failures at the 40% rated lifetime for qualifying data.
Cool.
All
right.
We did an analysis on total lifetime cost of ownership. So we want to understand, and you know, again, we're doing some projections here. We're using some round numbers. We're using some assumptions, and we'll walk through each of those assumptions. So, you know, we seek input on a proposal for lower lifetime based on, you know, considerations of technology neutrality, first cost. Rapid improvement in technology, I think I've pretty much harped on that at this point. This analysis is based on 20,000 hours of use. We examined current LED lamps, CFLs, halogen lamps, projected future LED lamp cost and performance. There are some assumptions here. Certainly, we could all do analyses of our own and arrive at different conclusions, but I'm just going to walk through this. So this is based on the industry convention of 3 hours per day. The assumptions are electricity pricing of 11 cents per kilowatt hour, an annual increase in electricity cost of 1%. So the first scenario on the left-hand side is one LED, today's LED lamp, used for 20,000 hours, $40, consumed 8 watts, and is operated for 20,000 hours, and we arrive at a total cost of ownership north of $70. The second scenario, second column, is two LED lamps. The first lamp is the one that I just illustrated, but it is operated for only 10,000 hours. This is the aggressive consumer or the early adopter consumer who really wants the most energy-efficient version that's available on the market. So they operated for only 10,000 hours. In 2020, they upgrade the lamp to a new lamp that costs $10, consumes 4 watts, and is also rated for 20,000 hours. So between the two lamps, the first one's operated for 10,000 hours, the second lamp is also operated for 10,000 hours. Total cost of ownership there, $70.
Alex, what's your $40 in that first scenario? You're saying the lamp cost is $40?
Initial lamp cost.
An 8-watt lamp at $40. I think the market has shown that it's a little bit lower.
Okay. Now, again, this is one illustration. I'll keep walking through it, and we can slice and dice, you know, the assumptions. And the third scenario is essentially what we're proposing here: a first lamp with an 8-watt consumption, 10,000 hour rated life. It's operated for 10,000 hours, and it costs $20. The second lamp in 2020. Purchased for $5, consumes 4 watts, and is rated for 10,000 hours. So in that analysis, we end up with a total cost of ownership of less than $50. I don't think I really need to walk through the halogen too much, but essentially over 20,000 hours, it's 6.6 lamps. We call that 7 lamps since you can't buy a fraction of a lamp. The cost varying between $2 and $4. It's hard to say exactly what that number would be, given that ISIN will kick in and we'll make that the baseline. But at the same time, the cost is higher for the technology. So per lamp, 3,000 hours. That's one way to look at it. So 43 watts per, and so we arrive at a total cost of ownership of more than $130. And then the final column, 13 watt CFL, 3 of them, $2 to $3 per lamp, 8,000 hours. Yes.
Kendall, Pennsylvania. What is your assumption on what happens in your second scenario? Two LEDs rated at 20,000 hours each, used for only 10. What's your assumption of what happens when that consumer switches? What happens to that lamp?
Maybe they go move it to another location in their house, perhaps, or.
So,
it wasn't considered as part of the analysis for that way. It was, I mean, you could also quickly say that it was thrown away.
There's a lot of ways to look at this.
Yeah.
Maybe it gets moved over.
Right. I'm just kind of prepping for future questions about your analysis. So, okay. Thank you. I'll hold this.
Real quick, the Noah Horowitz Center in D.C., the ISO replacement halogen tends to be 1,000 hour, so you would need 20 volts. You're showing 3,000 hours.
Yeah.
So that would be even.
That would be even higher. This is probably a conservative, but we all know that halogen's not the efficient option anyway, but that's a good point.
Okay.
The rapid cycle stress test. Let's just put the cutter right now. So the proposal is the lamp shall survive cycling once for every hour of rated life. So that's a minimum of 10,000 cycles if it's a 10,000 hour lamp. The proposed cycle is 5 minutes on, 5 minutes off. Looking at what's in the current integral LED lamp spec, a 2 minute on, 2 minute off cycle doesn't seem to be thermally stressing the lamps all that much. If you look at the temperatures, I need to replace the battery in this thing. If you look at the temperature swings, it's not dramatic. 5 minutes on, 5 minutes off would stress the unit a bit more. Okay, I'm back. So the passing requirement here, 9 or more units shall survive the number of cycles. CFL verification testing. DOE established a third-party verification testing program with version 4.0 of the CFL specification. And what that has shown is that rapid cycle stress testing is the most common reason for failure among qualified CFLs. We also see reviewing blogs online, reviewing articles in the media, our own discussions with consumers, speaking with retailers, over and over again, it is asserted to us that CFLs are not lasting, very often are not lasting to their rated life. So the packaging may say 8,000 hours, and they're saying that they get 1,000 hours out of it. Our sense is that consumers are very often generalizing that experience and then dismissing CFLs on the whole because of that. So we're really trying to ensure that these lamps are going to be more robust regardless of application or misapplication, which again often feeds into these misperceptions about energy efficient lighting generally. The proposed sample size has been increased from 6 units in the current specification to 10 units. It maintains the allowable single unit failure. And again, I already covered this. We're proposing 5 minutes on, 5 minutes off, which is in the CFL specification. So this is just a comparison of what's current and what's proposed. So minimum number of cycles of 5,000 in the current specification, sample size of 6 and 5 or more units need to survive. What's proposed is 10,000 hour minimum cycles, a minimum of 10, specifically 10 samples, and then 9 or more units would survive. So this does double the required testing time. The 10,000 hours of rated life with this cycling is approximately 70 days of testing. So draft 2, we do recognize that there was something missing in the initial proposal in draft 1, which is if you have a 50,000 hour lamp, you need to cycle it for 50,000 cycles. We need to address that. We recognize that that was missing in the original draft one proposal. Philip.
Yeah. Still premise on mass pass optics. Different lamps are going to have a different thermal mass, so the temperature swing for a 5 minute period is going to be different.
Yeah, we recognize that. This is sort of an extension of what's existing in the program without rocking the boat too terribly much. But I think there is a general understanding that, yes, two lamps are not identical.
And did you recognize the fact that every 5 minute cycles, if you have a 25,000 hour rated lamp, that's like 4,000 hours of test, and that contradicts with the 3,000 hour lumen maintenance test?
Yeah, that's the point he was just making, where we didn't address that in the first draft for those long life. We were thinking 10,000 hour products.
Okay.
So for those long lifetime products, where the 5 minutes off, 5 minutes on cycle accounts for more than the initial lifetime testing would be. We have to adjust the second draft. Frankly, if anyone has proposals on that, we'd love to hear them, but we'll come up with a regime to propose in the second draft.
This includes LED?
Yes.
Well, you mentioned CFL.
Okay, limited intensity distribution requirements. We did not have much to offer in draft one. We included a note box explaining why. We want to make sure that we come out with a robust proposal. But this is what's on our minds. If you look at the existing integral LED lamp specifications, right now if you have a PAR lamp, what's required is that you establish an incandescent PAR lamp that is to be replaced, and using the data of that lamp, that data is entered into the center beam candle power tool that PNNL developed. That tool spits out a center beam candle power. So, if I can get this mouse to work, benefit of the folks on the phone. So, the incandescent lamp may be providing you 2600 candela down the center beam. The existing specification requires that down the center of the beam you're producing the same intensity. However, what we don't know is what's happening in the rest of the distribution. So, looking at the existing crop of qualified PAR lamps, what we're seeing, and it seems to sell well with retailers, and we hear it all the time that the retailers love it, is sort of laser-like performance. Getting these lamps that claim equivalency to an incandescent lamp and provide a really nice hot spot down the middle, but because of the way that the specification is structured, there's no requirement for the quality of the beam outside of that center. And so this is what we're evaluating is how do we improve upon that experience. We're not exactly sure that consumers want a laser beam when what they're trying to do is replace the existing incandescent PAR lamp. So all of this was TBD in draft one. So we'll propose the requirements in draft two. And as with everything else, we're wide open to ideas and data and positions that you all have on this topic. But we have had some discussions with partners on this, and it does seem to us that there is some general concern about beam quality with these plants.
Thank you, Hafaran. Alex, are you aware that industry is working on this problem to define the beam intensity requirements?
Sounds like I need to catch up with you on that.
Okay.
Alex Bozenberg, NEMA, I'll amplify Becca's statement. We have gone on record with the Department of Energy stating we acknowledge this need to assist in equivalency claims. We are on the hook to DOE to answer this to the greater issue of all lamps, or as best we can. It's not a small task, but we would appreciate if you could defer to the national and international standards work on this.
Let me catch up with you guys on the topic. Thank you. The center beam candle power tool. Excuse me, guys. I've been getting over a cold for 2 weeks now. Center beam candle power tool, again, developed by PNNL. To the greatest extent possible, we don't want to rock the boat too much, so we are evaluating its usefulness for the new specification.
Question on that, Jim Gaines. Is there going to be a tool for the mains MR16 type bulbs, or are you not even going to bother with that if it's not in the new spec?
I would say that if the MOL.
So currently in the center beam candle power tool, there is, just like for PAR lamps, there is a similar tool for MR16s. We don't have that proposed to be covered in this draft of the specification, so we didn't include it. Obviously, if we do end up including MR16 lamps, then we'll need to do similar work on beam quality, or we'll need to coordinate with NEMA on their work on beam quality for those lamps as well. So.
Okay, I was asking specifically about the main MR16 types.
So
when Tim and I built this, they tried to get a pretty good sampling length, and they had a hard time getting a lot of line voltage MR16 data to populate this, and that's why this is not an effective tool currently for those types of lengths.
Right. The question is whether that's going to be added.
It would depend on whether it ends up in the scope of the...
If we end up covering MR16 in the scope, then I think we'd have to develop a similar tool for those
The justification for eliminating the low-voltage MR16 doesn't apply to the main ones because you don't have transformer and all these other problems that are causing that to be eliminated.
What I was trying to say before is... So if the MOL thing can be solved for the GU10 MR16 thing, we recognize that that's a segment of the market that seems to be growing. We don't currently have a calculator for line voltage MR16. The filament's larger, so the resulting requirement will be different. So we could take a look at developing or expanding the calculator to do that. So it's on our radar.
Okay, so I think we're a little bit behind schedule. We're trying to get for lunch at 12:30, and we still have a bunch of slides to go. I know that you guys are all excited about that. So I will try and click through these as expeditiously as possible. So these are the electrical requirements section of the specification. Again, just a quick note on sample size. Various tests within this section have different sample sizes. Power factor, start time, runout time have the standard 10 samples. Transient protection, actually the provisions for 5 units in a model. Electrical safety, operating frequency, and EMI, electromagnetic interference, currently are only requiring 1 unit per model, and dimming and noise are both still TBD. So the electrical safety requirements, the units must comply with the ANSI-UL 1993-2009. This requirement is carried forward from the existing specifications. There's not really a whole lot to say about this. Power factor. Power factor is required at one level in the CFL specification, another level in the ILL specification. We have a proposal for all lamps having a power factor of 0.7 in this draft of the combined lamps criteria. This is another area where we are very keen on getting feedback. There have been various debates about whether it's useful to have high power factor in residential lamps in the past, and particularly if you're a utility with a concern on power factor in lamps, we want to hear what your concerns are to make sure that there's justification for putting this in. So that's one thing we're definitely seeking feedback on. Yeah, Anthony.
Parking lot this for later.
Absolutely.
I just want to add to the parking lot request, specifically in understanding the benefit to the grid and also the benefit to consumers.
Okay.
So to be able to understand both.
Right. Okay, operating frequency. The operating frequency requirements, the requirements of method of measurement are to be defined in a future draft, but it is worth noting that EPA is working with various players, IEEE, IES, ASSIST from LRC, to identify appropriate methods of measurement and to ensure qualified lamps do not produce visible flicker or adverse health effects, those kinds of things. So this is still TBD, but it's something that a number of groups are working on, and EPA is doing their best to coordinate with those groups. The startup time requirements. Current startup time requirements for CFLs is 1 second. For intra-LED lines, there is no specific requirement. This draft proposes that all lamps shall be illuminated continuously within a half second. Starting is something that the CFL third-party testing technical working group has been working to define a procedure for specifically how to measure. This is our analysis and data shows that a half-second startup time is very achievable for the CFLs, which we have data for. We looked at dimmable three-way lamps, extra long life lamps. Nothing seems to particularly call out that it would be particularly adversely affected. There were some minor effects in dimmable three-ways that were a little less than standard, but everyone demonstrated the ability to meet, or every lamp demonstrated the ability to meet 0.5 seconds, so that's our current proposal. We've heard some initial feedback that maybe 0.6 would be better, but this is the proposal where we're at right now.
Parking lot?
Parking lot, yes.
startup time. Okay, run-up time. The run-up time proposal in this draft is quite a bit more detailed and a little bit more aggressive than the run-up times were in the CFL criteria. And again, the integral of the UNAS criteria does not have a specific run-up time requirement. But one of the reasons for, or some of the reasons for this is that run-up time is a very well-known consumer dissatisfier. As I mentioned, we have various sources of interacting with consumers. One of the things you didn't mention is that Energy Star actually operates several consumer hotlines. One of the most common complaints we get is about run-up time, and so this is something that is being proposed a little bit aggressively. For covered CFLs, which take a little bit longer to run up, the current requirement for CFLs is 1 minute run-up for non-amalgam lamps and 3 minute run-up for amalgam lamps. They don't break down that distinction in an effort to be technology neutral, but with the recognition that many of the cover lamps are using some amalgam technologies, that has to reach full stabilized light output in 90 seconds. For all other lamps, bare spiral CFLs, all the LED lamp types, the proposal is for at least 50% of stabilized output in 30 seconds, at least 80% of stabilized output in 45 seconds, and full stabilized output within that 1 minute. Again, this is something that the CFL Technical and Research Working Group has been examining. These proposals actually come from the California Superlamps draft specification. But here's some data on where the CFLs that we currently have qualified fall within. Now, one thing I'd like to note is that the current run-up time requirements are actually run up to 80%. So the new run-up time proposal is for 50%, 80%, and full light output at various points. So we don't have enough data to address how many of the current lamps meet the requirements in totality, but we do know that at least 70% of the CFLs have a run-up time of 45 seconds, which is the requirement for 80% in the new proposal. So there's a little bit lower of a number that is complying with the covered CFL requirement. However, again, because this is a known consumer dissatisfier, this is one area where we're proposing to be a little bit more aggressive. So, clarifying questions on run-up time.
Yeah. You've already providing signs. On LED lights, some LED lights, depending on the thermal characteristics, take a lot longer to stabilize. So what is the stabilized percentage? What defines stabilized?
So this, as it's being proposed, is full light output. It's basically your full rated light output, right? The full light output that you have to that you demonstrate when you're calculating your output.
Do you have any data for LEDs?
We actually don't have data for LEDs on this, and we'd love to have them. So if it takes LEDs a significantly longer time to run up, that's something we'd like to consider. So if you have data on it, we'd love to hear it.
Chad Stockwood, Phillips and Meleds, is this also going to include the color stability? Just going back to the four step and focus on that quality point.
It wasn't considered as color stability, whether the color needs to run up at the same time as the light output. This is focusing just on light output, just on lumens at this point, but it's an interesting question. And again, if you have data, we'd love to see it. So, do we need to parking lot this one for later as well? I think there's a general consensus.
Just a quick question. Does this define full light output, rated light output of the lamp, or does this mean that it cannot change after 90 seconds?
We don't have a formal definition at this point. I think that's one of the things that the CFL working group is working on. Right?
Yeah, the CFL version 4.0, for those who are not aware, that specification established the creation of a technical research working group for CFLs. And so the current group is working on addressing a definition of all of these things, run-up time, starting time, full rated output, how to measure it, at what points over time you take these measurements to establish whether the requirement is met or not. So within that group, we'll come up with a proposal that will come out of the group. We'll put it into a subsequent draft, and then it will be available for everyone's review and comment.
Additional clarifying questions
and start up around? Are we going to discuss in the parking lot the cost effect on this?
Absolutely, we can talk about that. Okay, dimming. Dimming is something that's constantly been a struggle for CFLs, and as LEDs come into the market, is something that that technology has to address as well. EPA is working with industry stakeholders, including NEMA,
and NEMA members, as well as the LRC, developed a definition, a method of measurement, and compatibility metric for renewable lamps. They're seeking to establish definitions on quality, what levels they need to dim to, all of those various things. It's not in the first draft and it's still under development. Again, if it's something that folks have particular thoughts or ideas on, suggestions for how to approach, I'm sure the EPA would love to hear those. Transient protection, this is carried forward from the previous specification, so nothing new here. Electromagnetic and radio interference, this is actually federal law in the United States. We sort of include it in the specification for the benefit of our overseas partners, but yes.
Go back one slide, please. LED lamps are exempt from the surge test. Back to your slide.
I'm not sure that's accurate.
Is that another
type of
no.
No, I'll speak to that. We've gotten feedback that the UL1993 stresses the LED component more thoroughly than the transient protection tested, so it was essentially an unnecessary test.
Yeah, so this actually may be.
I'm sorry, that's inaccurate.
This may be a typo.
Spec test for all lamps. We did investigate whether UL 1993 takes care of this issue, but we found that it doesn't. So that is in the specification for all lamps.
Correct.
We'll make this correction and the other one before it gets posted to the website. Sorry about that.
Good eye. Noise, once again, the noise requirements are still TBD. We need to have some noise requirements. No one wants buzzing lamps, but exactly how to structure that and exactly how to test that is still something that is undetermined and is being explored. So if you have ideas on this, we'd love to hear them.
Sorry.
Yeah?
You had a Class A requirement.
Class A. Class A. Class A, we investigated that, and Class A dates back to a study that a researcher on an Air Force base in the 1950s was doing to establish ambient noise ratings, depending on where you are on the base. So Class A was essentially, if you're inside a closet, inside of a basement of a building on the Air Force base, and you're about as far away from a jet as you can get, that's Class A, and that was 24 dBA threshold. If you're standing right next to the jet engine as it's taking off, that's Class H. So it's all pegged to ambient ratings, ambient levels. It's not necessarily really applicable to a product. So, and so all of that said, there isn't, as far as we can tell, an industry standard that actually codifies all of this. It was in that research, and I'd be happy to put you in touch with all of that. I think it was detailed in the notes in one of the drafts of the Luminaire spec. But it's our feeling that we can't continue to leverage this because it doesn't seem to have a solid meaning to it.
Fan specs often specify the noise at 1 meter. At 1 meter distance, the noise level. So maybe that's something.
We're wide open to proposals. Okay, so I'm going to take over and hopefully don't go into coughing fit. So lamp toxics reduction requirements. We looked at what the EU ROHS requirements had proposed. We used those ROHS requirements as a guide for what we proposed here. Looking at the 2013 ROHS level specifically. We've had discussions with manufacturers about what's feasible, what can be done with current technologies, particularly when you're putting the mercury in a pellet form. And so we arrived at these levels. I don't know if John Green made it here or not, but he was the one who pointed out to me that we have a problem with the language. No, we're not proposing that you must have lead, cadmium, and so on in the lamp. These are the limits. We're not saying that you must have those, so we'll get that straightened out for the next draft. It's important for people to focus on the specific language and the method of compliance.
for purposes of third-party certification, the documentation shall not be reviewed when the products are initially certified or during verification testing. So consistent with EU Rojas requirements, manufacturers need to maintain documentation on file to demonstrate that the products that are certified meet these requirements. If a problem should arise, if some third-party group does testing and finds that some manufacturer is off the rails and just pouring mercury into the lamps, EPA reserves the right to go to the partner, not to the certification body, to the partner and ask for that data. So that's how we've structured this. Okay, dimensional requirements. Basically, we want to make sure the lamps are going to fit. So the lamp base needs to comply with the relevant ANSI standards. We're concerned with making sure in terms of the lamp size, the shape, and ensuring that they fit into fixtures that the consumers will install them into. And we do note that if you take a look at the ANSI dimensional limits, the ANSI standards have outlines of what a typical lamp looks like, but then they also have limits, which are larger than that. So we do encourage partners to review those ANSI dimensional limits and consider the limits in the development of your comments.
Steve Arson, Lighting Times. Is anyone working on adding CMR-16 to the ANSI spec? Is there a working group involved?
The ANSI, the MR-16 plus GU-10 base?
Correct.
Yeah, there is an effort to do that going on right now.
There is, you're talking about a version of an MR-16 that has a larger MOL?
Yes, or just a spec so we can add that to the Energy Star.
There's a proposal in the ANSI C78 working group right now for a new MOL for a version of an MR-16 that's a little larger because of heat sinking. And the big one of the discussion points is don't call it an MR-16. Call it something else because it may not fit into applications that use the existing MOL for an MR-16. So that's a proposal that's been made, and it's going through the ANSI process now.
And that's one of our central concerns is if the consumer has a fixture that was designed for a halogen MR-16 and they're buying the Energy Star version, we want it to fit. So we recognize that current technology requires not necessarily passive heat sinking, but more active cooling, and sometimes the dimensions for that require more space. But the question is, if you do exceed those limits, is that going to fit into the picture that the consumer is trying to fit it into?
Jeff Gibbs from Nexus Lighting. I guess my concern, and maybe for the parking lot, is the timeline corresponding for the development of an MR-16 or a GU-10 based MOL standard into the timeline with what's going to be released with a lamp spec. Right now, if you talk to retailers, the line voltage GU-10 lamps are they're moving. And, consumers are buying these lamps. So when you look at Lowe's, Home Depot, Ace, these retailers are offering these lamps to consumers, and they are moving. So those need to be coordinated in some way with a concerted effort so that we don't short consumers the opportunity to have complete label on the lamp that they're going to buy anyway.
So Howard's my ANSI guy, and Jim, I know, is deeply engaged in this topic too. So my sense is that ANSI standards tend to be a little bit quicker than, say, IES methods of measurement. Is that generally the case, or how quickly do you think this could be addressed?
A lot of the CFL reflectors don't meet the ANSI requirements. So
Right.
So
we need to figure out a way to fit that in here. We need to figure out which lamps it matters for and which lamps it doesn't matter for.
I got another question. There are a number of ANSI outlines that don't have those larger limits, like the B and the C type lamps. We brought this up and just wonder what's
ICF is working on that right now. I've been in discussions with them on that, and we do need to have something in place for the new spec.
Do you have a proposal yet for what to do?
Not yet.
Okay.
It's on the list for a draft 2 or at least a subsequent draft.
Something we need to address. It could be months until that's decided.
Well, the spec process the way it goes, and we're looking at a few months to get the spec put in place. So you know, we're having this roundtable today. The draft one comment period closes December 9th, which is next Friday, and then we'll review all the feedback that we get on that, and that'll go into the development of draft two. Then draft two comes out. Same thing, comment period, review that, decide if we need a draft three, go to draft final, et cetera. It is a process that takes some time. There was another hand up.
I just wanted to make sure that we got the GU10 MOL sort of timeline thing in the background, as well as the general requirement for adding that type of
recognizing that the program has no control over that timeline, it is something that is on our radar. So maybe we just need to put the right people together in the room to talk about that.
Again, we can talk about it in the parking lot. It just seems as if this is a gating item for determining whether or not this is going to be included, right? And it's going to impact what's going on in the consumer space as well. And with the mindset of being able to protect consumers, we need to be aware of that.
Okay.
That's all.
Okay, so we've got about 20 minutes left, 2 months, so I'm going to try to fly through this. Lampshade dimensions and tolerance is claiming shape or wattage equivalency with standard or halogen incandescent. So we need lamps to comply with relevant ANSI MOL, maximum overall length, minimum overall length. There are instances where if the lamp is too short, it's not going to fit into the fixture. And also maximum lamp diameter. And it is also a question still of which lamps this is important for and which lamps it's not. Again, the intention here is just to make sure the lamps are going to fit into the fixtures that the consumers already have. And all of that feeds into what equivalency claims can be made on the lamp itself, the lamp packaging, product literature, and point of purchase materials. Okay, product labeling and packaging requirements. So in terms of lamp labeling, this is something that was already in place for GU24 lamps. For years. The intention is that we want to make sure that the consumer, when they take out the old bulb, they have instructions in front of them on what it is that they need to go by to replace it and have the same experience. And so what we proposed is lamp manufacturer, and we also do recognize that we've received some feedback that some of this stuff is already required by safety organizations, so subsequent draft will reflect that. But basically, we're looking for the consumer to be enabled to identify who the manufacturer is, how to get in touch with them, the model number, if that's pertinent, well, it needs to be on there, I believe, watt and lumen output, color temperature, an indication, I believe this is required by safety, of whether it's dimmable or not, and then what the limitations are for the application of that lamp. As well as whether it contains mercury and also this electrical safety. Jack?
Jack Herman, LED transformation. Should that have some kind of minimum font size?
it's a lot. You make it so small that nobody can possibly read it. So.
You can't put it on a lot of the lamps.
I'm positive we're going to get a lot of feedback on this. And except for those comments, Mark, do not post. They'll all go on to the website so everybody can see what comments everybody entered.
David from G, just can we add this to the parking lot because it's a big deal?
Sure, Jen.
Jen, I'll bring it. Is the phone number new?
Yeah. All of this is new. For the CFL, it is?
G24, some of this was required, which I don't recall, but.
We floated phone number. There's another way to do it. I don't think. First, there has to be recognition that the packaging is gone. So for the argument, the consumer can just revert to the packaging. There's no way they're keeping it. So the question is how they get in touch. They have a phone number. They have a website. We have a print of physical mailing address on the land. Probably not. So it's a question of how does the consumer get in touch with the manufacturer if needed for warranty purposes.
Having the manufacturer's name on there.
We have a website.
If these things are expected to last for 8 years, are the products going to be relevant anymore? Are we expecting them to be different 8 years from now?
Well,
if somebody takes one out on the first side, would they want to go get them?
Sure, but for instance, if the consumer has a 2700 Kelvin lamp and we want to make sure that they're going to get that warm white experience next time they go to replace it, we want them to have that sort of information. Likewise, if they have warranty issue and the lamp doesn't last, we need them to be able to get in touch with the manufacturer. Sounds like it's on our parking lot, so I'm going to keep going so that we can get through all of this. Packaging requirements at minimum in English with additional languages as necessary for the market. Model number, Federal Trade Commission Lighting Fact Label, equivalency claims.
We need to come back to that too.
Okay.
Equivalency claims or the whole thing?
Packaging.
Just packaging. Warranty, we propose minimum 2 year based on no less than 3 hours per day. Mercury content labeling, packaging needs to indicate whether it contains mercury or not. Lighting fact label can accomplish that. Dimmable lamps, we're asking that packaging more clearly call out whether the lamp is dimmable or not. My mother-in-law, for instance, she's got recessed hands and recently put in 5,000 Kelvin non-dimmable lamps into ICAT, insulation contact, airtight, recessed hands on a dimmer. I know they're going to fail, and they're going to fail quickly. And so she's just a perfect example of the, you know, the consumers trying to get it right, but their mindset is pegged toward a lamp that thrives on heat as opposed to a lamp that really does not thrive on heat. So this is the aim of our packaging request, our proposal here, is that front of the packaging indicate whether the lamp is dimmable or not to try to make this more clear to consumers. Incompatibility with controls, this is much the same as in the past. We need packaging to indicate to the consumer whether or not it can be used or should be used on a circuit with a timer or a photo sensor or what have you. Incompatible applications, packaging exterior proposed should state specific applications that would compromise the performance of the lamp. This includes installations that would result in the lamp's non-compliance with the Energy Star specification requirements. This includes totally enclosed fixtures, insulation, airtight cans, damp locations, etc. Restricted position, we talked about that earlier. Minimum, maximum, minimum starting time is to carry over from existing. Okay, one of the more controversial proposals. For years and years and years now, we've been trying to educate consumers on how to go from the incandescent warm white lamp to something that they are satisfied with and uses 75% less energy. Retailers have been involved in this. Manufacturers, utilities, EPA, the Department of Energy, FTC, who else? Everyone's been involved in trying to tell consumers how to understand correlated color temperature and how to pick the right bulb. And how many times do we read articles where the writer says, I didn't like the CFL, it was too harsh, the color was really blue, and it's just evident to those, to us lighting folks that they just didn't pick the right CCT. And they didn't understand it, and it's understandable that they didn't understand it because they've been for decades now, perhaps their entire lives, using incandescent light sources down to the warm end of the spectrum. We know that from our own conversations, especially the conversations that Taylor's been having with retailers, that point-of-purchasing materials are not always referenced. Shelf talkers are great and everything, but we can't necessarily rely on them. What we do know is the consumer looks at the package. So that's why we're focused on this. So we feel that a consistent, uniform message should help. So there are a number of verbose slides that follow this, but instead I'm going to go into sort of a visual demonstration of what it is that we have proposed. So what we're suggesting is that what we're proposing is that manufacturers would use this same gradient across all Energy Star qualified lamps, and that this would be printed on the front of the packaging. These brackets would indicate a range that manufacturers would have to work with in to make some sort of designation of what the color temperature is of the product. So first, this illustrates to the consumer the concept that there is a gradient. There isn't just one color temperature, warm white, that you get from incandescent. You have a range of temperatures. So the proposal is, we give you the graph, or we give you the gradient, you guys figure out how to employ it. And we try to make the language as loose as possible to enable as much creative freedom, recognizing this is a huge ask, asking for front of package real estate. So what we're saying here is, for instance, you can use whatever type of iconography that you want to use to indicate where the product lies on the gradient. So whatever icon works well for you. On top of that, we're asking also to explain to the consumer that there is a gradient. We're proposing that warm white be illustrated on one end and cool white be illustrated on the other end. The language that we inserted into the specification allows for manipulation of this gradient, recognizing that branding is a very important aspect, and that you guys would need freedom to work with the gradient to implement it however you think is best. So different font sizes, different shapes. It could be, of course, it could be scaled. When the image is scaled, the brackets would need to be scaled also, so as to maintain that position on each unit. Again, it's a matter of consistency, making sure that the same gradient is used across all these packages, and from one package to another, 2700 Kelvin is, for instance, illustrated in the same position from product to product, from manufacturer to manufacturer, from technology to technology. So you use those brackets to find the point, and then you cut away the bracket and employ the terms warm white and cool white. It could be used vertically. If you don't mind, I'm going to finish going through this, and then I'll take questions on it. It could be used vertically. Of course, it could be scaled. You pick your spot on the chart. Once the spot is located, you carve away those brackets, and you label it. So I'm just trying to illustrate many different ways to use the gradient, different ways that you could denote along the gradient where the product lies. It's not intended that it has to be square. It could be cut out in many different ways. If you're selling CFLs to kids, I don't know. So hope you guys don't sue me for doing this, but I took a few of your packages and just did a few mock-ups to illustrate some of the ways that this could be implemented. It doesn't necessarily have to be too obtrusive. I think it is something that could be implemented in most any full color packaging. We do recognize that not all packaging is full color, so we need to talk about that as well. But these are some of the ideas behind this. Again, trying to improve the consumer experience, trying to get them on board with energy efficient lighting, trying to dispel these myths that energy efficient lighting looks bad, looks too blue, is too harsh, whatever the concern is. So that is the proposal. And here's all the words behind it. Basically, it's a high resolution TIFF file. I should mention this is the same gradient that appears in the DOE lighting facts label. Our understanding is that label will no longer be used on product itself. Now that the FTC label is being implemented, this again is a sort of regurgitation of the language that is on that is in the specification. We've also proposed that front panel would include terminology that it would explain. So we need to get some feedback on these various terms.
Can we talk a lot about the terms? Especially neutral white.
Yeah, sure. This is a mock-up, just one idea. So we have discussed this with FTC. We recognize that that the commission has already ruled on this. They've put together the final ruling on the lighting facts label. We also recognize that this is something that is difficult for manufacturers to implement overnight, and something that maybe doesn't need to be implemented immediately. Perhaps there's a way to phase this in. I think there's a lot of different ways to approach this. I'm in touch with Hampton Newsom and FTC and trying to figure out is this something that could be revisited over time. So now I'll shut up and take Jen's question.
Thank you. I'm glad that you said that about FTC, as that was my question. because I do think that the lighting partners meeting, or the partners meeting, this having two of these, one in black and white per FTC and one in color for Energy Star, it can't do anything but confuse consumers. And I know that all of these comments you've proposed to the FCC, and the FCC essentially didn't take them, so it comes across as, well, we didn't get our comments there, so we're going to require it on the Energy Star packaging anyway, which, again, goes to the our concerns about, first and foremost, confusing consumers, and secondly, dealing with government agencies that are contradicting each other. I'm glad that you said, perhaps phasing it in over time, you know, we have ESA coming in. We have the FCC labeling coming in. We've got a whole lot of things that we don't know how they're going to affect the market or the market's going to respond to them. I don't think we need to add this at this point in addition to everything else, especially since, you know, you have several things that you want on the front of the packaging, which you don't reference here, but all the other things that you said need to be on the front of the package. So you know that is the toughest, you know, real estate. I don't think we need to be adding this for all those reasons.
Yeah, it's our first proposal. It's a dialogue. We're at draft one. You know, we need to talk this through more thoroughly. I think some of the limitations of just to respond to some of my thoughts on it. Some of the limitations with FTC's final ruling are known. You know, a black and white scale does not illustrate the concept behind it. And if we can't get consumers to understand the concept, you know, that the black and white label may work well for a halogen lamp. But consumers pretty educated on what they're going to get in terms of color temperature. But for any phosphor-converted source, whether that's fluorescent or LED, there's a range. They need to understand the concept, and letting facts label from FTC stops short of getting there. So, you know, I guess one could look at it and say, well, the EPA didn't get what they want, so they're going to do it this way. It's really just trying to get consumers to understand this, and so we're putting it out there as a straw man to, you know.
And understood, it's just really whether we agree with the color versus black and white, we are faced with the requirement of the black and white, and we don't want to confuse consumers with two. That's the main point.
Becca Hakkarainen, to add to Jen's point, I'm also concerned that consumers will misunderstand the color as meaning that these are colored lamps. Mm-hmm. I would, before I'm comfortable with this, I would like to see consumer research that shows that they understand this correctly.
Okay. Yeah, and you know, this illustration was our initial proposal. Perhaps it's the case that, you know, the 2700 bracket needs to shift over to the right a little bit in order to convey that it's not above light. You know, we need to talk this through more thoroughly, but I think...
I would be concerned that people would go for the 4,100K
right.
lamp here because they want white light.
Yeah,
right.
Okay,
fair
enough.
Yeah, that was my concern. My concern was the consumer's going to be looking at a 5,000K lamp and thinking he's buying a blue lamp. And looking at that 2700K chart and thinking he's buying a yellow light, a yellow or yellow orange or whatever. And to me, this is more confusing than having a black and white chart. On a black and white chart, the consumer has to go and figure out, at least has to find out what it means. He sees three different colors. On this one, he looks at it and he looks at 4,000 saying, that's the white light that I want.
An issue I'd like to see either in the parking lot or the subject of another meeting, this is Alex Bosenberg, NEMA, is a discussion of, I guess I'd call it policy, of solving issues through labeling or solving issues through testing. One example is elevated temperature testing. Your justification earlier was that they won't read the box. So why do we have to have 64 slides of justification for why we have to put certain stuff on the box if they're not going to read it anyway? I think we should pick one and, you know, pick the audience and then aim the solution at that audience. And I would suggest that defer on the side of education The label is handing them a fish, teaching them what color is. It's teaching them how to fish. And I think that money would be better spent on consumer outreach and education on the concept of color rather than millions of labels, changes, and just the cost of printing color labels.
Sure. How about the idea, and this is a broader discussion, I agree, this could be a day-long meeting of its own. How about this?
Part two. If you don't have a meeting room, you can have mine.
How about the idea that we collectively have been trying this for a decade, and we're still okay? And I recognize that I sort of overreached when I said they don't read it. Every consumer learns a little bit differently from the other, but some will read it. It seems evident that a great many do not read it. So what do we think about the fact that more than a decade we're trying to convince consumers or educate consumers on this, and it doesn't seem to be working?
You can lead a horse to water, but some people just want to be right.
Retail display.
I agree this probably does warrant its own parking lot, and we're only going to be able to tease out it today. Just a couple of quick observations. All the examples you showed, used the term soft white, which this doesn't embrace. I don't know that, but that's just an observation. Also, even if we do something like this, we've seen marketing continue to use terms like natural light, daylight, and those seem very appealing. So, and that drives people to the 5,000-ish lamp, which they probably don't want. But natural sounds good, so the other's unnatural. So this is a big can of worms.
And then the term bright white is sometimes employed. And what is?
But that's marketing, and that's, yeah, to some extent, not necessarily government decision.
Right. So how much, despite what we do, is marketing going to undo this? So it's challenging.
We're interested in finding a way to better educate the consumer and recognizing this.
Mike Friedberg, Kind District Consulting. My package includes a use of multicolor print. So to add label like that would require different printing patterns on the packaging. And I'm not sure it's worth added cost just to put this little strip on it.
Particularly if it's not going to increase consumer adoption more than focusing on quality or focusing on lifetime or focusing on performance. And so I concur with the idea of the label being put into perspective in terms of our overall goal of increasing consumer adoption. My mom, my grandmother, my aunt is not going to buy the lamp because it's black and white versus color.
Okay, well, We made it all the way through. I think we can all use a break. So I said this before, comments are due by Friday. Next Friday, lampsatenergystar.gov. You can copy me, but it would help a heck of a lot if you send it to lampsatenergystar.gov, because that's where we're aggregating comments. Jen Dolan.
Question for logistics. Are you locking these doors so that we don't have to go through the security again? Otherwise, we have to do that now.
Are you satisfied that either EPA or a contractor will be sitting here guarding the room?
Oh,
of course.
That work? Okay.
Yeah, that's
sure. Fine. We will ensure that somebody is here and no unidentified people walk in and muck stuff.
Thank you.
Sure thing. Hey guys, here's where to get lunch up on the screen.
Where are we?
I don't want pizza.
All guests have been unmuted.